Delaware courts have sort of given shareholders more rights to sue not just directors, but officers over compliance policies that have failed to prevent positive law violations. It used to be called the Caremark case, used to be called, you know, the most difficult kind of a case for shareholders to succeed, but it's a forum in which shareholders can sort of hold the directors and officers responsible.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. Back in May, we had one of the foremost American experts in corporate governance on the show, Professor Stephen Bainbridge, to tell us about his new book, The Profit Motive, which is a straightforward defense of the shareholder primacy theory. That is the idea that pursuing any corporate aim that doesn't maximize shareholder value is in conflict with the legal and practical purposes of a corporation. Today's guest has bravely reviewed Professor Bainbridge's book, and his new essay, Beyond Profit Motives, offers an alternative theory of corporate purpose beyond what he calls ruthless profit maximization for shareholders. William Moon is a professor of business law at the University of Maryland School of Law. His research focuses on corporate governance, offshore finance, and private international law, and his articles have been published in leading law journals. Will has also been named Teacher of the Year by the Black Law Students Association of Maryland Law, and we're so thrilled to have him here today. Will, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. So I guess I want to start with the same question I started with Professor Bainbridge with. What inspired you to write Beyond Profit Motives?
Yeah, so I've been noticing both in legal academia and those who I went to business school with and law school with who are now practitioners, that there is a real push for corporations to embrace social responsibility, sometimes under the banner of CSR, sometimes under ESG, that this is a real movement, but a movement that I think needs a better theoretical foundation, sort of explaining why corporations ought to embrace certain breeds of social responsibility. What I'm also mindful of is that some of the most prominent voices in American corporate law, including Bainbridge, including other legal scholars and Delaware jurists, don't actually adhere to this idea that corporate managers can subordinate the interests of shareholders, that even though stakeholderism or stakeholder welfare might be good for shareholders, that at the end of the day, the balance has to weigh in favor of shareholder interests. So I wanted to sort of engage with this longstanding debate and also just tee up my sort of ideas. And I just absolutely adore the format of a book review. I think it's a great platform to really tell people that, you know, there are good books out there that are really worthy of a read, which I think Steve Bainbridge has done, but also a platform to tee up some new ideas that might get the conversation started even further.
Yeah, it's great. It's really fun to read one framework like Professor Bainbridge's and then to read your response to that. And it's interesting because, as you mentioned, there's a growing attention served to ESG and CSR. And now we're actually seeing like a backlash to that, you know, so it's gone back and forth. But why don't we take a few steps back? And can you tell our listeners about the basic debate, which started with maybe Friedman's theory, his essay back in 1970?
Yeah, absolutely. So Milton Friedman is a Nobel Prize winning economist who, you know, produced a lot of work, but probably most famous for writing that New York Times Magazine essay that's provocatively sort of entitled "The Social Responsibility of Business is to Increase Its Profits." And I think in various iterations, it represents a version of what academics refer to as shareholder primacy, which is basically an idea that corporate directors and officers are people who are really hired by shareholders to make decisions in the best interest of shareholders who have hired them. Stakeholder capitalism is also something that is sort of a broad umbrella, but it rejects the notion that corporate managers and corporations exist just to maximize profits, that there are a broad range of groups like employees, suppliers, consumers that are directly impacted by corporate decision making, and that these are important constituents that corporate decision makers ought to consider when they make decisions on behalf of corporations. I think in some versions of stakeholder capitalism, some scholars embrace this idea that if there is a true conflict, that corporations don't actually have to just focus on profits, that there are other pro-social agendas that they can actually pursue.
Okay. And where does Professor Bainbridge fall in that debate?
Yes, I think Professor Bainbridge is actually a fairly mainstream American corporate law viewpoint that this whole system is really built to effectuate shareholder interests. He adheres to this notion of shareholder value maximization, which I think contains two related concepts. One, he's not advocating for shareholder profits in the short run. That is, you know, CEOs shouldn't just be looking at quarterly earnings, ruthlessly going for what's best for quarter four so that we'll all do really well in stock compensations, et cetera, et cetera. He's really looking for long-term shareholder profits. It's also a more sophisticated version, if you would, of a shareholder profit maximization view, in that under his paradigm, and he's very clear about this, that executives can actually consider stakeholder interests. So the interests of employees, consumers, suppliers, investors, communities, as long as the decisions are ultimately made to primarily benefit shareholders. So the real sort of disagreement between the Bainbridge school and some of the more leftist, if you would, stakeholder capitalism sort of proponents is, what if there is a true conflict between long-term shareholder profit maximization and some of the goals of climate change or board diversity? What do corporate decision makers actually have to do? So I don't think it's a very radical idea that Professor Bainbridge is really trying to defend. It's really sort of teasing out those various strands and sort of saying, this is where I draw the line.
Yeah, and he gave pretty convincing and well thought out reasons to support the paradigm and and his position on the debate. One that it seemed in your essay you were particularly bothered by, which was Bainbridge's position that stakeholder capitalism is fundamentally anti-democratic. Can you explain that argument? It was a pretty provocative and interesting argument he put forth. And why do you think people are turned off by it?
Absolutely. So his argument, which I sympathize with in at least some forms, is that, well, you're pursuing all this ESG agenda because you've really failed to persuade the majority of citizens through a democratic process to enact certain laws that require individuals and corporations to actually follow some of your pro-social agendas. And actually, if you think about it, it really resonates and comports with a version of what Milton Friedman said, which is that call for social responsibility, the corporate social responsibility, or CSR was sort of the buzzword at the time, was that it's preaching pure and unadulterated socialism. So I think it's a new version of this understanding that, well, if you really want to accomplish certain environmental goals or social goals, then convince the rest of your citizens to actually enact those laws and our administrative agencies to enforce them, rather than having these unelected executives pursue those goals. So I have sort of three reactions to that understanding. One is that I don't think stakeholder capitalism is necessarily anti-democratic. There are lots of different versions of stakeholder capitalism, but to the extent that stakeholderism is really about promoting social goals through encouraging corporations to sort of better obey law and to have better compliance systems to better effectuate existing laws on the books, I actually think it's a better version of pro-democracy. That is, rather than having laws on the books that routinely get ignored, we want to make sure that laws are actually effectuated by encouraging the corporate decision makers to have compliance systems in place that discourage lawbreaking that's pretty rampant. Agree. I think the second important point is that corporations, especially large corporations, are increasingly in the business of making decisions that are traditionally what we call, you know, roles that are played by the state. So anyone that's listening to the podcast might have a Twitter account or a Facebook account. These are private companies that really dictate who can speak in what format and who can get banned from certain platforms. These are important sort of roles that generally are governance issues that are made by political communities through a democratic process. So I think there's a sort of, there should be a more robust understanding that corporations, private corporations, are really making decisions that affect our political rights. I think one sort of argument that gets missed in this, well, if we allow wealth accumulation, that's political liberty kind of an argument, is that if you look at Gallup polls, I think about half of Americans, maybe 40%, a little bit more than 40%, don't actually own stocks. And stock ownership is vastly concentrated on wealthy Americans. So it's not a system that really even pretends to be egalitarian. So I think, you know, people, average Americans who are able to access our wonderful capital markets and accumulating wealth and that leading to political liberties is really great, but it's not a system that's designed for everyone by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. And you said something before about the tech companies and the platforms that they host and that looking like the work of government. And it's true. I mean, I feel like we've come to a place where these corporations are so large, they're so gargantuan, they have such an outsized influence that we have no choice but to at least partner with them in the democratic process. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. And I mean, to a certain extent, we do see both clashes between governments and corporations, but there are also more collaborative regimes where, you know, sometimes governments engage in privatization efforts to delegate responsibility. Sometimes corporations serve public functions. But I think we all sort of need to better recognize that it's not just about, we can classify corporations as private and corporate law as private law. Therefore, we ought to ignore everything that goes on in those affairs, that it doesn't really affect our political rights. I think we really need a better sort of nuanced understanding of the issue.
Right. Yeah, those lines have definitely been blurred. So in comes your theory in your essay, which you call the new concession theory. So can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, what's the old concession theory? What's the baseline? And where does your theory pick up on that?
Absolutely. So the old concession theory, or various iterations of the concession theory, traces its sort of intellectual origins to a 1819 U.S. Supreme Court case, very famous Dartmouth College case. But it's the general understanding that corporations ought to engage in social responsibility because corporations are state-created entities. That is, you literally need a state charter to form a corporation. Therefore, since you relied on the state for the benefit of your sort of birth, that we can impose social obligations. I think, you know, that theory still is kicking around. I think it's one of the theories that really support stakeholder capitalism. But I think this is an area where I think Bainbridge does a really, really good job of debunking, which is that back in the day, chartering was a privilege. You literally needed state lawmakers to enact laws that give birth to universities, that give birth to various types of, you know, railroad, canal building, all kinds of public functions. But these days, anyone that's formed a corporation can tell you that it's a ministerial process. It's that states are, to the extent that states are involved, it's a ministerial process. It's a routine process. It's not really a privilege that that are selectively doled out by state governments. All you really have to do is go to a Secretary of State's website and pay some fees and click your mouse and you have a corporation. The new concession theory really forces us to understand the state's role in the process of corporate creation better. It rejects the view that the privilege comes from states chartering entities, but it really is a recognition that any kind of social responsibility comes from the fact that corporations are just a large groups of people that are pooling money for business enterprises, and more specifically, strangers who pool large amounts of capital for enterprises. And these are sort of complex economic activities of long duration. And in order to do that, you really need the state, the government, the legal institutions, the coercive authority of the state, if you're more sort of political philosophy sort of inclined kind of a person. And this recognition that private ordering alone can't really enable the formation of large enterprises. And I really draw heavily on the work of Professors Taisu Zhang and John Morley's work, which was published earlier this year in the Yale Law Journal. So it's really a better understanding of where the legal authority behind the corporation really even comes from, which I think can lend support to sort of various intellectual movements that are calling for more social responsibility.
Okay, so it's not a product of the chartering statutes. It's something that's more baked into the corporation's very ability to exist. I mean, you have this great line where you say, because a corporation is necessarily reliant on the modern state's legal institutions, it should put in effort to uphold the infrastructure responsible for its existence. Can you just talk a little bit more about why it's so important when, what you said before, when you're organizing a large group of strangers, because there's a trust problem there, and what role the state plays and how important that is?
Right. So if we sort of look back to prior to the emergence of modern states, there were, of course, business enterprises. You can go all the way back to the Roman Empire. There are, of course, various private enterprises that don't rely on government or state-like institutions. But if you want to pull a lot of money from a lot of different individuals and instill some sort of understanding that your money is not going to get stolen, you really want to enforce the corporate bargain, you really need some form of government authority, and that we haven't really come up with other types of trust-based institutions that could replace the state. I think some tech enthusiasts might say, oh, blockchain, that was going to sell trust. And I'll be disproven, maybe in the decades that are coming, maybe that can replace some state functions. But I don't think we've, at least up until now, come up with a reliable system in which humans can trust the system to let go of a lot of capital that can give rise to large-scale business enterprises that we see today.
Okay, so now, so you're saying that, you know, we rely on the government to enable us to enter into those types of organizations, those business organizations and arrangements. Where do you make the leap, and how do you make the leap from that to, therefore, these business enterprises should be engaging in ESG?
Yeah. So
is it a should or is it a could? Also, is another question I had.
I think it's more of a could. So I think a version of the new concession theory might look more like better enforcing laws on the books or giving a reason why corporate decision makers need to have better compliance systems in place so that we don't have a regime where corporations pursue profits and get the proverbial sort of slap on the wrists anytime you break environmental laws on the books, for instance. So I think it can support a version of ESG. It's really understanding that some of the ESG goals can actually be accomplished through enhanced legal compliance and legal obedience. So one example of that, I'm writing a full-length article called Extraterritorial Corporate Governance, which I argue that you know, some of the things that the Alien Tort Statute was designed to accomplish, which is the statute that allowed, you know, corporations to be sued for engaging in mass scale human rights violations and environmental degradations abroad, that this statute purportedly sort of allowed tort victims to sue corporations. I think corporate law can actually play a function in deterring lawbreaking that goes on abroad, similar to what those kinds of laws are designed to do. So I think it's an underappreciated toolkit that we ought to explore. But I think if you are sort of a more hardcore ESG proponent that we don't actually have to rely on laws, corporations have the moral obligations to do something about climate change, for instance, I think you can also make the argument that the new concession theory would support some versions of that as well. So I don't think it's a sort of a narrow theory that requires one objective and that's it. I think it's more of really a descriptive project that's aimed at understanding where any kind of obligations ought to come from. And I think that can lead to various, you know, disagreements and debates about how to draw the line when it comes to social responsibility. I think in one sense, what the new concession theory does is help us understand that there are actually many different versions of even the shareholder primacy theory. So I think mainstream corporate law scholars, including Bainbridge, won't go as far to say profit maximization and that is it. I think most scholars would say profit maximization, but there is a duty to obey the law. So I mean, there are some people that have said you can ruthlessly pursue profits, even if it means breaking the laws. But I don't think most people agree with that. I think most people will say profit maximization, but you have a duty to obey the law. I think where there's a sort of disagreement is just because you say corporations obey the law, I don't think that gives us enough to understand where this trade-off occurs. That is, should corporate governance itself require managers to put in a lot of effort to ensure that the corporation's thousands of employees don't break certain types of health regulations, environmental regulations, labor regulations? To what extent does it require the corporations internally to police their own agents from violating the law? And I think shareholder value maximization or profit maximization people really need to understand that those trade-offs can really powerfully impact the bottom line behavior of corporations. That is, we can have a regime where directors and officers can predictively sort of encourage lawbreaking and go away with a liability-free kind of a regime. We can also have a system where corporate officers and directors are subject to Caremark suits, for instance, all the time, in which they actually have less discretions in terms of how they make corporate decision-making that affect the corporation's bottom line. So I think those are, and there could be many different sort of spectrums of how those trade-offs occur, but it is something that I think we ought to pay more attention to. That is, you can't just say we have a regime that requires corporations to pursue profit and obey the law. That actually does not give us enough to understand what is actually motivating corporate behavior, what is and to what extent we ought to draw the line in terms of a corporate law regime that may or may not police certain types of behaviors.
Yeah, that doesn't get you there. That just that, you know, having laws. And I agree that I don't think Professor Bainbridge would argue with you that corporations are and should be required to maximize profits within the bounds of law. The question is, should we beef up those laws or should corporate boards and managers just be more draconian about following them and their own internal policies? Are you saying that breaking the law, are you saying that if shareholders are bringing derivative suits, they must see that as good for the long-term value of the company? Is that right? Is that fair?
I think that's fair. With the recognition that shareholders, there are various types of shareholders, and some of them care about more than just long-term profit maximization. So there might be a lot of different motivations behind shareholder suits.
So, but if corporate directors started to implement in the way that you describe and say, okay, we need to be much more mindful of our employees breaking the law, and maybe we're subject now to more Caremark suits, Is that good for business? I mean, tell us about that. Because now you're defending lawsuits all the time, and now you're kind of it's starting to impinge on the business judgment rule. And like, how does that impact the bottom line?
Yeah, it's a really, really great question. And I think it's a difficult project. I might be spending the rest of my career exploring those issues. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that not all of corporate law or corporate governance mechanism is designed to maximize profits or even effectuate shareholder interests. There are duties that we impose on corporate directors and officers, particularly when it comes to sort of obedience of the rule of law, that's not really focused on solving this agency problem between shareholders and managers, but are really more designed for public interest. And I think, you know, scholars like Professor Elizabeth Pullman has done a really good job of fleshing those kinds of interests out. And I think, at least from an instrumental standpoint, and you don't have to just rely on an instrumental standpoint, but even from an instrumental standpoint, you can make the argument that a very lackluster compliance regimes that allow corporations to breach law, that at the end of the day, the public will be very unhappy about, might lead to more radical versions of law that might undermine shareholder interests. So think of Elizabeth Warren's sort of proposal about how to regulate corporations. Think of the EU directive on corporate sustainability. Think of more radical measures that might actually be terrible for shareholder value that you might indeed sort of inspire or subsidize by having lackluster compliance regimes.
Right, right. But you also make the point that no matter what the regime in place is, more and more corporations are finding ways to evade them. And you give some examples of the mobility of capital, the, you know, cheap labor, creative lawyering, which gave rise to things like offshore tax accounts. And even Citizens United is another kind of roundabout way of putting the corporation in charge and kind of dictating how the law will apply to them.
Absolutely. And I think this is where it gets really complicated. So corporations rely on law for its very existence, but can also sort of outstrip the modern state in their political and social significance. So, you know, I think the well-documented phenomenon of tax evasion and is one sort of example of that. But I think that although corporations are good at evading certain types of laws, I don't think you can just transcend laws. I think states can also push back and enact laws that are designed to sort of close loopholes, more aggressive forms of extraterritorial regulations that can also police corporate behavior. So for instance, if you look at the EU directive, it applies so broadly to corporations that have any kind of nexus to Europe. It doesn't even have to be European-based corporations. So as much as corporations might be really good at evading laws and coming up with new kinds of private ordering mechanisms, the state can also be very aggressive in how they enact laws to catch up with those kinds of trends. And I think sort of it's impossible to physically exit from the state entirely, right? I think there are some, I think it's too much of an exaggeration to say that, well, all of capital and all of employees and all of executives can actually leave the state. I think people enjoy living in the United States. I think people enjoy living in New York and other places where we can still enact territorial-based laws.
It made me think of crypto, because crypto has this like no one owns us type of model. And it looks like, you know, they want the future to be, no, there's no government involvement. There's no middleman.
That's such a great point. So if you look at proponents of sort of blockchain-based business entities, the DAO, a lot of them are actually fighting for state lawmakers to enact DAO-based laws, LLC laws, that really require state lawmakers to bestow upon them some privileges like limited liability. So I think you know, in some sense, some, you know, tech or crypto enthusiasts might say, oh, we're transcending the state, no regulations can affect us. But that sounds really more like 30 years ago when people used to say, oh, the internet is transcending the modern state, therefore no laws can affect things that are going on in the cyberspace, which we know has received the scholarly burial that it deserved.
Okay. You also mentioned in your essay, Will, that this mostly applies to large business enterprises. Why is that?
Yeah, so the new concession theory, the short answer is yes. I think it mostly affects large enterprises. And the reason is that I'm not really concerned that much about business entity classification. That is, just because you formed a corporation, we now can demand social responsibility. So just to give you an example, let's say an entrepreneur is about to sell fancy t-shirts on Etsy and goes to the Secretary of State's website and pays $150 to form a corporation. She can now call herself the CEO, the sole board of director, but it's unclear to me why we can demand social responsibility because she just clicked the mouse and formed and did some glorified paperwork. But I think for large scale business enterprises, companies that have market caps at $1 trillion, $500 billion, I don't think that you can pull enough capital from a single individual or even narrow groups of people to form those kinds of entities. You really need dispersed strangers to be able to pull capital. And I think that's when we can really demand social responsibility from large-scale enterprises.
Got it. Okay. So you also write in your essay that it's the new era of enhanced oversight duties that have the potential to better align the interests of corporations with that of societal interests by shaming directors and officers complicit in lawbreaking. I thought that was a really nicely put. So, and I think one thing that you probably would agree with Professor Bainbridge about from his book is the idea that corporate law would have to basically be rewritten if we were to adopt a stakeholder capitalism regime. As it stands now, corporate law gives shareholders the right to make important decisions, right? They elect the directors, and then those directors have their own fiduciary duties. They can be enforced again by the shareholders. So I was hoping you can give us an example that was really relevant because the decision came down this year, actually in March. And that is, and it's a company everyone knows, everyone's been there, McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And what happened with their officer and the shareholder derivative suit there as kind of illustrative of this whole idea about bringing their incentives more in line with these derivative suits.
Yeah, absolutely. So McDonald's was a case involving sort of this culture of sexual harassment at McDonald's that shareholders thought that their directors and officers ought to have prevented. And I think it's one of the, so I mean, everyone freaked out when the decision came out, but I think it's part of a slew of cases where Delaware courts have sort of given shareholders more rights to sue not just directors, but officers over compliance policies that have failed to prevent positive law violations. It used to be called the Caremark case, used to be called, you know, the most difficult kind of a case for shareholders to succeed, but it's a forum in which shareholders can sort of hold the directors and officers responsible whenever or when there's a serious sort of systemic breaches in the system that enables the violation of the law. I think it's a version of stakeholder capitalism in the workings. That is, we're not calling for corporations to embrace or obligating corporations to engage in sort of climate change activism that are not required, but it's really a better internalization of existing laws on the books that can accomplish a lot of the goals of what ESG proponents are calling for. It's not a perfect mechanism by any stretch of the imaginations. There are lots of different critics who criticize Caremark decisions on a number of different grounds, but I think it is one of the ways in which we can sort of effectuate the goals of social responsibility without sort of changing everything about how corporate law works in this country, which seems to me a little bit more unrealistic.
Right. So the McDonald's case gets more to that S&G in the ESG. And we already have, you know, rules of the game that allow the shareholders to make sure that there isn't sexual harassment in the workplace and women and minorities are protected. And you know, so what you're saying is, yes, use these mechanisms to hold them accountable. But it sounds like, and would you agree that what if we don't have the laws on the books? So for example, we don't have like a super comprehensive environmental or climate law yet. I don't think that is directly applicable to these types of organizations. It sounds like you would say, yeah, then in that case, we're not there yet. Like we should not be asking corporations to go really hard on the environment because we haven't put the law in place. Is that right?
I think that's my personal view. But as I write in the essay, I think my own theory, the new concession theory, can actually lend support to people that want even more radical changes that are not necessarily tied down to enacted laws. I think social responsibility can come in many different forms. One might be better enforcement of existing laws on the books. But I think I can imagine other people making the argument that we need more radical forms of change and that it can be more than just enacting laws, that there are sort of ethical obligations of corporations to engage in social responsibility. And maybe that's good for profits. Maybe that's not good for profits.
I know there's so much pressure on these business leaders to make money, and there's so many competing pressures for them that I do wonder sometimes that whether these derivative lawsuits, whether the Caremark claims, whether the policies coming out from your compliance department, you know, is there any evidence that they actually create real change, or are they just looked at as like the cost of doing business?
Right. It's a good question. And in one sense, directors and officers, practically speaking, don't pay out of pocket for these suits. So one can say, oh, it's just a slap on the wrist. No one really cares. But I think the directors that I've spoken to and who other scholars have documented actually do care about these lawsuits. It can significantly affect their reputation as board members. What we do know about board members is that they care intensely about their reputation because it affects their ability to serve on other boards. So I think in a sense, this sort of shaming mechanism of being sued for creating an environment of sexual harassment or creating an environment that led to 3 people dying from a listeria outbreak in the Bluebell case, I think it does have a potential to significantly affect the sort of the culture of how movers and shakers make decisions that, you know, affect a lot of people and affect a lot of important sort of social agendas.
So that actually stands in contrast to something Professor Bainbridge writes about in his book, which is that it's basically all smoke and mirrors. It's a lot of lip service. We're a culture obsessed with what to say and what not to say. We're not really into the ideas themselves, but how we talk about the ideas. Even the Business Roundtable, which he claims is what, you know, inspired him to write the book, they did that about face on ESG in 2019. And he claims that even that is just a PR move. What do you think about that?
So like all good lawyers, if the sort of question is, are some people doing this for smoke and mirrors and it's just a PR campaign that might be very undoubtedly a yes, right? There are of course people like that. But I think one of the things that the ESG movement has accomplished well is really helping corporate leaders and shareholders and everyone else understand that if you care about the environment, if you care about climate change, if you care about human rights, that might actually be a good thing, even if you're a pure profit maximization, shareholder interest is all that we ought to care about, that it's really better understanding what shareholder profit maximization means. And it's not about ruthless profit maximization in the short run, that social and that embracing ESG, embracing things that are good for society, probably most likely is also good for shareholder interest. And I think that is a true and important accomplishment, even if some of those movements can lend support to greenwashing and sort of managers skirting accountability.
Right, right. So you mentioned at the end of your essay that your theory, the new concession theory, is a promising starting point. What questions does it leave open? Like, what avenues are next to explore in the next, you know, if we adopt this theory? What's left to write about? What's, I mean, I know there's a lot. There's, it opens up a lot of interesting questions. So what are some that you can share with us?
Yeah, so I really want the piece to be more of a conversation starter. I think the last time I wrote a book review for the Michigan Law Review, it led to at least three or four articles. So I think at the baseline, I think the new concession theory can really support various different types of social agendas that could be more radical versions that are adhered to by some proponents of the ESG, that can be more quote unquote sort of conservative approaches that look at social responsibility only through enacted laws. Where we draw the line and with what consequence is something that I think can be and should be explored. I think it can also give insight into how we think about enacting laws that might serve the public interest better. I also think descriptively, and these are probably too academic of pieces to sort of have interest among practitioners, but I'm really sort of interested in questions about why corporations obey the law. That is, these are juridical entities. These are legal fictions constituted of lots of different people with various types of interests. So I think I'm hoping that the theory can also spark conversations about why groups of people decide to engage in lawbreaking and what can actually police them from engaging in behavior that could be harmful for society. So there's lots of different, I think, projects that can come from this, and hopefully it can really get people sort of excited to write more on the topic.
Absolutely. Yeah. And let me ask you this. Have you spoken with Professor Bainbridge about this book review? I think I saw he posted something about it on his own blog.
Yeah, so I sent him a draft and he commented on it. So, but I don't have a personal sort of relationship with him. So so that's one thing. And I have also interestingly heard back from some of the sort of prominent people in the academy who have reacted to it. So,
well, you have a really interesting and a thought-provoking critique of the profit motive. And we are going to be paying close attention to see in what direction the new concession theory takes us. Thank you, Will, so much for your time today and for your insight.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.